Celebrate 50 years with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics. Hi, I'm Sabine.
And I'm Adam. Welcome to this very special 50th episode of Robots. With 81 interviews and nearly 150,000 downloads, Robots is fast becoming the world's premier podcast for anything related to robotics or artificial intelligence. For this, we want to thank you, our listeners, for your continued support.
To celebrate our 50th episode, we are also launching a brand new website to accompany our podcast. Our new site is chock full of great new features, which should make it even more interactive than before. You can now easily post your comments on each episode and start a discussion with other listeners or give us feedback on our work. Episodes are now easier to browse than ever, with related episodes grouped together, interactive lists by topic or by interviewee, and a featured episode section. Be sure to have a look at our website at www.robotspodcast.com and let us know what you think.
Now, let's get on to today's episode. To celebrate 50 episodes of Robots, we're doing a review of some of the greatest advances in robotics during the last 50 years and predicting on what we can hope to see in the next 50 years. We'll be talking to experts across the different fields of robotics to hear their opinions on these two questions. You'll probably recognize some of our guests from previous shows. Given the large amount of topics we want to cover, we'll be splitting this special in two parts, with the second episode online in 2 weeks. Today, we'll be talking to Rolf Pfeiffer on robotics in general, Mark Tilden on robot toys, Hiroshi Ishiguro on androids, Oscar Schofield on underwater robots, Steve Potter on brain-machine interfaces, and finally Chris Rogers on robots and education. In our next episode, we'll be giving a snapshot view on nanorobots, AI, flying robots, human-robot interactions, robot business, and space robots.
Fate has it, this year is also the 50th birthday of robotics, which is the theme of this year's International Conference on Robotics and Automation. Robots will be there, so expect some interviews on the freshest topics in robotics. But first, before we get started, let's hear the latest news in robotics from Christine.
Thanks, Sabine. Some of you may remember the PR2, a high-tech humanoid service robot built by Californian company Willow Garage from one of our previous reports. Researchers at the University of California, Berkeley have now developed an algorithm that allows the robot to fold towels of different sizes, colors, and materials. What may not seem to be a big breakthrough for some, nevertheless marks a milestone in the robotic manipulation of non-rigid, deformable objects. The challenge in perceiving and manipulating deformable objects like towels is that unlike rigid objects like doors or bottles, their shape is not predictable. A video shows how the PR2 picks up a towel, slowly turns it with one arm and then with the other, while scanning it with a pair of high-resolution cameras. Once the robot finds two adjacent corners, it starts folding in the air and finally completes the fold on a flat surface before adding it to a neat stack. Details of the work will be presented at the 2010 ICRA conference in a couple of weeks. Japanese company Honda has demonstrated its U3X personal mobility prototype in New York. The device has a slight resemblance to a unicycle, but is probably best explained as a one-wheeled, sitting version of the Segway. It allows a user to drive in all directions by shifting their body weight forward, backward, or to either side. The U3X's stabilization algorithms are derived from Honda's research with the Azimo robot. The device also uses a specifically developed one-wheel omnidirectional driving wheel system to allow simultaneous forward and sideways movement. While the maximum speed of the U3X is a mere 6 km per hour, less than a third of the Segway's, it is significantly smaller and lighter, weighing only about 10 kilograms or 22 pounds. For now, no information on pricing and availability has been released. Researchers at the Personal Robots Group at the MIT Media Lab wrote to let us know about a new online game to study human interactions. In the game called Mars Escape, each player can take on the role of an astronaut or robot on Mars who must work together to complete various missions before oxygen runs out. In the current first phase of the study, the researchers study how human players work as a team. In a second phase, later this year, the researchers will use the data collected from human players to build a model of how they interacted for task assignment, action synchronization, and problem solving. The model will then be tested by creating an in-game AI. The long-term goal of the project is to create robots that are able to assist and work with humans in a natural, predictable, and robust way. To this end, the researchers will recreate the game environment in real life this summer at the Boston Museum of Science and test their behavior model using their MDS robot, Nexi. For more information on this episode's news, including videos of the PR2's robot folding towels and Honda's U3X and links to the Mars Escape game, have a look at the Robots Forum at www.robotspodcast.com/forum.
Our first guest today is Rolf Pfeiffer, one of the leading figures in robotics and AI, straight from the University of Zurich.
Hi Rolf, welcome to Robots.
Hi Sabine.
What have been the major developments in robotics over the last 50 years?
Okay, I think we have to distinguish between different kinds of robotics. One is industrial robotics, and I will not say much about that. There's another kind of robotics, a more recent kind, which you could call bio-inspired robotics. And I think, of course, we can talk about various technologies, but I think what really have been the major, or one of the major developments, is certainly that robotics has turned from, let's say, an engineering discipline into a highly interdisciplinary field where biologists, people from sports science, biomechanics, neuroscience, engineering, computer science, material science, in particular also developmental biology, developmental psychology, they all collaborate. And I think from there, we will actually gain a lot of insights. This goes together with a development, a conceptual development, that we are beginning to understand how intelligent systems function. And I think a major buzzword that fits in there is the one of embodiment, so that we're beginning to understand how intelligence and the physical existence actually cooperate, or how intelligent behavior emerges as a physical system interacts with the real world. So the physical system is not just something that sits there and needs to be controlled, but the physical system is actually a prerequisite for intelligent behavior to emerge. And we're beginning to understand how the physical interaction with the real world leads to patterns of sensory stimulation that contain correlations that are structured, which then constitute the raw material for the brain to process and to learn about the real world.
And what is your prediction for robotics in the next 50 years?
Okay. Well, actually, I have to say that I'm not really very much into prediction. Of course, I could say the usual stuff, you know, like people like Ray Kurzweil or Kevin Warwick or Hans Moravec, Bill Joy, and all those who sort of feel that they know about the future, you know, about cyborgs, that we will have chip implants, and then we have robots at all scales, you know, like bacteria and swarms and the transhumanists. And then they talk about things like the singularity, which is when the machines will become much more intelligent than human beings, whatever that would mean in detail. I think I will leave the speculation up to those people and to Hollywood and maybe to children and to science fiction. Having said that, I think that there will be major breakthroughs in robotics. Well, one of the things that will happen probably is that the term robotics, now the robot is a particular machine which is at the center of attention, that will probably disappear and, you know, merge into a much more general sort of type of machine that will be more ubiquitous. The second point that I would like to make is that the breakthroughs will not come from classical engineering as a discipline, but it will come from, let's say, the joint cooperation that has started already, joint cooperation between people from different fields. In particular, I think we can focus on material science, biology, and we will have things like growing materials. Once we have growing materials, then we can really apply biological principles of development. And rather than design things, we can actually grow things. Now, going back to the speculations about the future, what people also like to say is that when the singularity occurs, that is when machines get so intelligent or much more intelligent than humans, they will enslave mankind, you know, kind of these Hollywood scenarios. But we have already been enslaved by the machines. If you remember, for example, the year 2000 problem, we were forced by the computers to spend billions to deal with the year 2000 problem. We didn't do it because we wanted to. We were forced by the computers, and we couldn't pull the plug. Whether we want to attribute evil intentions to the computers is a purely philosophical question and not a scientific one. Now, I think I would like to finish here by using a quote from Niels Bohr, the famous physicist, who said, "It's hard to predict, especially the future."
Thanks, Joel, for being here with us on Robots.
Okay, well, thanks very much for asking.
Our next guest is Mark Tilden, robot designer at Wowie Robotics, an inventor of Beam Robotics and the Wowie Robo Sapien.
Hi, Mark. Welcome to Robots Podcast again.
How are you doing?
Can you tell us what you think were the major developments in toy robotics over the last 50 years?
Well, since 1960, I guess the biggest innovation in toy robotics has been the quality of industrial design. Has gone from sort of like the sad little box robots of the 1950s to the much more stylish things that we've come to recognize today as part of our storylines. And, of course, the advent and rise of inexpensive motor systems and control systems. All of these things have basically allowed us to take robots from what were essentially imagination devices into things that actually do walk and talk, just like we've always anticipated they would.
Okay, and what do you think, what are your predictions for toy robots in the next 50 years?
Well, the advent of control technology will improve. For example, like the cost of actually controlling the motor is now becoming far more affordable than it ever has been before. What's going to be interesting is basically seeing what people are going to actually do with the toy robots, because they're going to start basically blending between, say, toy robots and really useful robots. And those are going to be quite interesting. For example, I can envision in the next 50 years that the personal Fisher-Price Predator drone will have to have an NRA sanction so that it can fire heat-seeking missiles, just as the National Rifle Association says the forefathers intended. On the other hand, I can see that the rise of humanoid robots is going to wind up being quite interesting, along with believable cats and, you know, like robot goldfish and the like, that basically you don't have to worry about feeding if you happen to go on a long trip. Basically, we're going to see an awful lot of magic happen in the next little while, where the instruction manuals for control and toy control will become an awful lot more intuitive and natural as artificial or real-world artificial intelligence becomes much more mainstream.
Great. Thank you very much, Mark, for being on the show again.
Okay. All right. Nice talking to you. I'm glad we've made up.
Next, we go on to Hiroshi Ishiguro from Osaka University in Japan, who just released his new Geminoid F. He'll be telling us about the past and future of androids.
Hi, Hiroshi. Nice to have you back on the show.
Hello.
What have been the major developments in androids over the last 50 years?
Yeah, well, we don't have so many android projects in the world. Probably our project is quite unique, and especially in a research area. If we look at the other area like amusement park, of course we will see the android. But as a research, I don't know other project. I know a couple of projects about android, but they are just for example the android head. But the other researchers, they don't develop the android itself, but they're rather interested in the humanoid. As you know, in the humanoid, the Japan, for example, Honda and Sony, they are taking an initiative, but the other European researchers and American researchers, they are also interested in the development of humanoid robots. So the android, I started the Android project 10 years ago, and we have improved very much. And finally, we reached to the teleoperated android of an existing person. I mean, that is my copy. And if we teleoperate the very human-like robot and android, so we can exist in a distant place. So my research approach is we could confirm the possibility of the android technology. So that is my feeling about the development of androids.
And what is your prediction for androids in the next 50 years?
Probably we are going to use more android in real societies. Of course, my purpose of development of the android is not just for developing the commercial product, but to study what is humans by building android. And so my interest is in the understanding of human itself. We are working with the companies, and the companies are interested in developing the commercial product. And the customers, for example, museums and the some companies are running exhibitions. They are quite interested in the use of Android, and maybe we can start with that kind of a small market, and then we can deliver the Android in other areas. So actually, I think Android. Especially the teleoperated Android will be a new information media after the cell phones. Cell phones could bridge people anytime and anywhere. But next, as the next information media, what we want to have is the media that can transmit our presence to the distant place. So we want to have that kind of different types of media, and that different types of media can have a possibility to change our lifestyle again. So, as you know, the Surrogate is a movie that made in Hollywood, and the movie is displaying the one of the possibilities, how they really are going to use the Android in the near future. I believe, that is quite strong possibility. You know, of course, that's going to be a limited field, but so I guess we are going to use more Android in the near future, and Android works instead of us, as the surrogate robot. So that is my prediction.
Thank you, Hiroshi, for your insight on androids.
You're welcome.
Our next guest, Oscar Schofield from Rutgers University in New Jersey, dives into the field of underwater robotics.
Hi, Oscar. Welcome to Robots Again.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Can you tell us what are the major developments in underwater robotics over the last 50 years from your point of view?
There have been three major advances. One, the robots have become sturdy enough to go out to sea. The ocean is very salty, which is very harsh on robots. They can go to great depths and the extreme pressures. And so there's been structural advances. The other big advance has been power. The problem is getting out to sea is hard and it's expensive. And so you need your robots to last a while. So advances in battery technology have been a big, big advance. And then the real big, big advance is communication. Usually the robots can't speak to you when they're underwater. In the past, they were no longer within sort of radar range to talk to them. But with the Global Iridium system, you can talk to a robot anywhere in the world. And if you can talk to it, you can assess its state and try to help it along. And I think that is the fundamental advance.
Now that we have robots, underwater robots in the water, what do you see as the next advances that we can expect to see from them in the next 50 years?
I think robots are going to transition from being a cool sort of demonstration to a cool sort of tool for science. And it's going to transition into being a huge tool for society. Robots will be how we will monitor and manage our water quality going forward. It's better than doing it with boats and humans. They'll be used to optimize commerce in the sense we'll know because of the robot data, how to drive ocean forecast models that will help shipping. It'll help us for conservation. We'll be able to monitor what animal life is there, and that will hopefully help us manage fisheries and endangered species better. And then finally, I think the real big thing it's going to do is we live on a water planet. Climate is to a large extent driven by the ocean, and yet we have very little data, especially in areas that are showing rapid change. And I think networks of smart robots carrying many different sensors so we can look at how climate influences the physics of the water, the chemistry of the water, and the biology of the water will be what we'll see happening in the next 50 years. To make that happen, the robots are going to get smaller and cheaper. And so it won't be $1 million a robot. Hopefully it'll be $20,000 a robot. So what we'll have is not just one robot in the ocean or two, we'll have tens of thousands, because that's what we need to answer a lot of the big pressing questions.
Great, Oscar. Thank you very much.
No problem.
Let's move on with Steve Potter from Georgia Tech, who will be telling us about brain-machine interfaces.
Hi, Steve. Great to have you back on the show.
Thanks, Sabine. It's great for you to invite me, and I look forward to listening to this and many other shows of yours in the future.
What do you think have been the major developments in brain-machine interfaces over the last 50 years?
Well, let's see. I suppose that they pretty much started about 50 years ago, and we could talk about interfaces that involve brain stimulation or ones that involve brain recording or both. Let's see, but in the 50s, James Olds figured out where in the rat's brain to stimulate to cause a rewarding experience, stimulating part of the basal forebrain that evolved in us to help us remember to do things again that we did right. If we do something right, we feel good about that, and we should remember to do that again. Well, he did this in rats and got them to do silly things again, pushing levers to get food or whatever. And subsequently, Jose Delgado used the same idea in, say, a bull to stop it from charging at him. He had a remote control that he could use to stimulate the bull's brain and get it to run in circles instead of charge. Also in the 60s, Sandia Labs had a similar brain stimulation set up for donkeys, I think, or mules, where they would have a solar sensor, and if they aimed their walking along a certain direction according to where the sun was, they would get rewarded. And so in some sense, they were creating robots out of these animals, whether they were rats or mules or whatever, considering the original meaning of the term robot, which was worker or slave or somebody who deals with the drudgery. So that's probably not the kind of robot that robots podcasts are usually about, but it's important to mention that if we're talking about brain interfaces, those were some of the very earliest ones, brain-machine interfaces, were the stimulation interfaces. On the recording side, the most obvious application is to create some kind of prosthetic device that perhaps could be replacing a missing or disabled limb that's controlled by neural signals. And you could also talk about sensory prostheses. Some brain-machine interfaces restore some missing sense, like a cochlear implant that helps deaf people hear. But to talk about the motor prostheses, I think the biggest development on that end started with Miguel Nicolelis and John Chapin probably about 15 years ago now. And when they recorded activity directly from a rat's cortex and used it to move a little robotic arm that would bring water close to the rat's mouth and it could drink that way. And the rat originally was moving this by just moving its actual arm, and they recorded the activity that the brain produces when it moves its real arm. And then they turned off the control that was controlled by the rat's real arm and just used the brain control, and the rat eventually learned to just think to move the arm and didn't even bother moving its real arm. Subsequently, Miguel Nicolelis with Jose Carmena and also Andy Schwartz independently have done these kinds of experiments with monkeys and much more realistic arms that that move in a more anthropomorphic way under the control of recordings that they get by putting electrodes in the animal's cortex. So that's that research is moving right along, and I think that the John Donahue and his colleagues also have now done this in humans. A few humans have had electrode arrays implanted in their cortex, and they've used signals that they recorded from those to move a robotic arm, say, for a paralyzed patient who has no ability to move their limbs at all. They can also use those signals to move a cursor on a computer screen, so it's not quite a robotic interface, but it's similar in the idea of what they're trying to accomplish. Let's see. Phil Kennedy is another person who's developing interesting neural interfaces to allow locked-in patients to communicate with the outside world. So he's got special electrodes that have good durability to last for years and is recording from parts of the brain that might produce speech and allow the people who are paralyzed to speak again. This is at the early stages, but I think that this is very exciting. And let's see. So that's in terms of recording from intact brains and using those signals to move robotic devices. There's also been a number of advances recording from brain parts in vitro to move robots. So Sandro Musa Ivaldi probably was one of the first people to do this using an interface to a lamprey brainstem grown in vitro and use that to control a Keppra robot. Our lab at Caltech and then at Georgia Tech used cultured neural networks that we got from rat embryos growing in culture and interfaced to computers that were controlling the Keppra robot, also the K-Team's Koala robot. We used the networks to drive those around and most recently have developed electrical training protocols where we can send sensory information and stimulation into the culture to try to get the robots to move in a certain way that we're looking for. So I would say those are the main advances that I can think of in terms of brain-machine interfaces in the last 50 years. I'm sure there are many that I have missed, however.
And what is your prediction for brain-machine interfaces for the next 50 years?
For the next 50 years, that's a long period of time to predict. It's difficult. I can say, based on where we are now, that there will be a lot of improvement in our ability to interpret the EEG signals that can be recorded from the scalp. So the brain waves, it's a much less invasive way of picking up brain signals than putting electrodes into the brain. And presently, the resolution of the EEG is on the order of a centimeter or so, which is terrible resolution compared to what you get when you put an electrode into the brain. However, people are developing really good analysis tools to process that blurry data and sharpen it up and make it faster so that one could conceivably control robotic devices much more dexterously than we can now using EEGs. Another thing on the horizon, at least 10 years on the horizon, would be to use the magnetic signals emanating from the brain. A magnetoencephalogram, or MEG, is currently a very technically difficult thing to do. You have to have a big shielded room, and you have to use liquid helium to cool superconducting quantum interference devices. If those things could be made with room temperature superconductors and we didn't need liquid helium, then perhaps we could make some sort of portable helmet that could record magnetic signals and perhaps also electrical signals from the brain non-invasively. I think that would be a fantastic advance. It's probably going to happen in the next 50 years or so. I would say that based on some progress that's going on already with prosthetics, recording signals from muscles is going to become more sophisticated. So people who are missing limbs usually have some muscles left in the residuum that they can record from, or perhaps other muscles in their trunk that can be used to control robotic limbs. And that's at the very early stages of usability. So those things could definitely be improved in terms of the spatial and temporal control of prosthetic limbs. For the invasive prostheses in the next 50 years, certainly we're going to have electrode arrays with lots more electrodes. Currently the technology is about 100 electrodes or so. And we have 100 billion cells in our brain, so we've got a few orders of magnitude there to be able to catch up to record all the activity going on in someone's brain. Another important advance is two-way interfaces. So currently these motor interfaces are just recording signals and using those to control something. And I think it would be much more effective if we not only recorded but stimulated and then looked at the effects of our recordings. This kind of closed-loop technology is something that we're working on very hard at Georgia Tech. And a lot of other labs are also interested in using it for the kind of brain stimulation that gives therapeutic benefits, like for Parkinson's disease. But I think it could also be used for prosthetic devices. You can imagine if you had a prosthetic arm that also had a sensory system so that you could feel temperature and texture and you could feel what position it was in with proprioception, then it might be much more effective than the numb prosthetic devices of today. So that's going to be a big advance. These two-way interfaces, I think, are going to be a big advance in brain-machine interfaces in the future. And then probably on the farther horizon, but maybe within the next 50 years, we'll move on from using wires to using optics, probably, to interface with the brain. Currently in the lab, we're already exploring, we and a lot of other people are exploring these kind of optical neural interfaces. in which you can stimulate neurons that have been genetically labeled with some kind of light-sensitive ion channels, and you can record from neurons that have been labeled with some kind of fluorescent protein that's sensitive to the cell's membrane voltage. So you can go in both directions, the stimulating and the recording with optics, but the technology is very crude, it's difficult to implement, and it would take a lot to improve it to the point where we could use it in humans. If we could, if we get to that stage where it works well in humans, we might use it for more advanced things than just controlling prosthetic devices. I could imagine all sorts of applications for both mind reading, some kind of interfaces that could be doing cognitive tasks, and also perhaps for electrical training or optical training of neural circuitry to help recover from stroke, for example, or even just to help normal people learn better. So I'd say those are my main predictions for the next 50 years or so of brain-machine interfaces.
Thanks, Steve, for your insight on brain-machine interfaces.
You are welcome. Thanks for asking.
Finally, Chris Rogers from Tufts University tells us what he sees in the future of robots in educating your youth.
Hi, Chris. Welcome back to the Robots Podcast.
Thanks.
Tell us what you think were the major developments in robotics and education in the last 50 years from your point of view.
So I would say that probably the biggest ones were first the invention of the computer and then the microprocessor, which allowed kids to our students to start building robots easily. And then more recently, the idea of sort of prepackaged microprocessors that make your life a lot easier. So Lego Mindstorms being the one that I'm most familiar with, but certainly the Arduino and the Parallax and a couple of these other basic stamp systems where you could get started right away and actually be able to clip a few things together and see some results. Also, a fair amount of work has been happening more recently also on materials choices, so trying to pick out trying to find the influence of different materials on your robot, so maybe not all your behavior comes from sensors and actuators and intelligence, but it comes from the materials you pick, so some of the neat robotic fish, for instance, and what sort of materials they use for the tails.
Chris, tell us, where do you see robotics in education in the next 50 years? Where do you see it developing?
So I see one of the big powers, I think, of robotics in education is that kids get really excited about building their robots, and along the way they realize that they have to understand some math and some science in order to make their robot do what they want. And so it's an excellent motivator for them to learn fundamental math and fundamental science. It also is an excellent motivator for them to learn fundamental engineering, so learning how to work in teams, how to solve problems, how to communicate their solutions, some of the things that are necessary for engineering from design on up. So in order to continue to increase the number of kids that have the opportunity to do this and to drop it into the lower and lower age groups, I think you'll see more and more companies coming out with different robotic platforms where kids have a hand in the intelligence that goes inside the robot. So you can already see a number of products out there where the kid can tell a pre-built robot to do various behaviors, starting in kindergarten or first grade with the BeBots and some of these other ones, to more high-level ones where kids will be able to choose different modules that they'll snap on. So they maybe need it to recognize their voice. They maybe need it to be able to see. And so they'll snap on these different modules together and then give it some sort of intelligence through programming on a computer, or maybe even just how they put these modules together might define how the behaviors work and who gets precedence and so on. And so I would see that being one of the major developments in the next, probably the next 10 years, is it becoming a regular tool, just like a calculator in schools, to teach kids math, science, and engineering. The other thing I see is the whole world of social networking playing a huge role in the robotics in the next 50 years, from everywhere from kids and teachers sharing what they've done and what works effectively in their classroom with other kids and teachers around the world, to even robots talking to each other through the internet. And so I could foresee something where you'd have kids actually having a robotics competition, even though they're not in the same place, and they being able to see their robot move in the real world and somebody else's robot move in the virtual world in some sort of augmented reality type setup where the two robots could interact and share data or collaborate or compete.
Great. Thanks a lot for those very interesting answers.
Sure.
And that's all we have for today's 50th episode of Robots. Don't miss the second part of this special in 2 weeks. And now that the show is over, come have a look at our newly designed website at www.robotspodcast.com and let us know what you think about our show through our new commenting interface.
Thanks for listening. Hope to see you in 2 weeks.
Celebrate 50 years with Robots, the podcast for news and views on robotics.